Mesopotamia, 321 BCE. The villagers see a flash of light on the horizon, a bright blink like a thunderbolt, the sun reflecting on an olive branch made of gold. They stream out of their homes to meet it, this otherworldly carriage. Indeed, no one in the ancient world has ever seen anything like it before, because nothing like it has ever been made. 64 mules strain to pull the cart, their harnesses adorned with gold and jewels dusted from the road. It goes painfully slow, because they are towing a cart with wheels as tall as a man. Its roof is made of gold, fashioned in the shape of a palm tree, and at its peak, the polished golden olive branch. Under its shade is a gold sarcophagus, draped with purple cloth, rippling in the hot wind, upon which lies the weapons and ornaments of the god-king that resides within it. The Great Alexander. But where, the villagers wonder, is this funeral procession going? Could it be to the territory of Ptolemy in Egypt? Or to Macedon, Alexander's home kingdom? Well, the answer to that, friends, will determine the fate of empires. Thanks so much to Raycon and their new bone conduction headphones for helping our history come through loud and clear. Just before Alexander the Great died, as his generals, closest companions, and family gathered around him in his palace at Babylon, one of his last acts was to give his signet ring to his general, Perdiccas. However, though Perdiccas was a renowned cavalry commander who had the support of the army, he was not intended to be Alexander's successor. Oh no, because Alexander already had heirs. His favorite wife, Roxana, was 6 months pregnant with their first child, and if that baby was a boy, he'd have a direct successor. Meanwhile, Alexander's half-brother, Philip III, was another option, but he was intellectually disabled. While respected as a figurehead and treated well, he had never been trusted with real power and was likely to be a puppet king. Add to that the fact that Alexander was already mute from illness when he gave Perdiccas the ring, so his exact intentions were unclear. But it is generally assumed, both now and then, that Perdiccas was being designated as an executor to sort out both succession and the empire. Basically, he'd been made trustee of the most complicated estate sale in history! After all, we're talking about the largest empire of the classical world. And in addition to Alexander's brother and unborn child, there was also his mother and a number of sisters whose marriages could give various commanders claim to the throne. These claimants to Alexander's legacy, his generals, friends, and family, will come to be known as the Diadochi, the successors. And real talk, they are all itching to either divide the spoils or roll the dice and try to claim it all. So, days after Alexander's death, Perdiccas convened a conference that would come to be known as the Partition of Babylon that would attempt to answer who would rule the empire and how they would govern it. This conference was not without strife. In fact, some sources claim this first council had to disband briefly, as the army's infantry commander led a mutiny and besieged the palace, attempting to crown Philip III. In the chaos, Ptolemy had to rally a guard around Alexander's body, while Perdiccas fled an assassination attempt and rallied the cavalry to crush the rebels before reconvening. As a result of the uprising, Perdiccas struck a bargain with the army faction who'd supported Philip III. Alexander's brother would indeed be king, just without any true political power, and would reign until Alexander's child was born. Because should that child be a boy, they would then name him Alexander IV and install him as co-ruler of the empire. For what it's worth, this gamble paid off, as Roxana did indeed deliver a boy. And meanwhile, Perdiccas would rule as regent. Yet despite all that drama, the second part of the council was actually trickier. See, there were two competing ideas about how the empire would work in the aftermath of Alexander's death. One, which Perdiccas seems to have championed, would leave the empire intact as a unit, held in trust to be governed by Alexander's line. But a rival faction, consisting mostly of Alexander's generals and companions, wanted to break up the empire and rule it as a council based on the League of Corinth. Ptolemy, one of Alexander's closest companions who had been close to the king during his stay in Egypt, was the leading voice arguing for that solution. And Perdiccas likely suspected that Ptolemy fancied becoming a divine king himself. Yet there was no other option. The empire was simply too big to administer fully from the center. So, after extracting promises that these men would serve as governors, not kings, and swear to act under the orders of both he, Philip III, and the future Alexander IV, he doled out the satrapies. There also seems to be some kind of division of treasure, particularly the vast treasury of the Persian Empire. In this, due either to pragmatism or pressure, he gave Ptolemy the incredibly vast and rich land of Egypt. However, Ptolemy was to leave in place the current governor, who would serve as his subordinate, and Perdiccas hoped a check on Ptolemy's ambition. Ptolemy, for his part, played along, at least until he returned to Egypt and established control, at which point he killed the guy who was supposed to be his backstop against his ambition. Well, yeah, but I don't really like you championing that for some reason. Anyway, this was useful in a few ways. First, it removed checks on his power, obviously. Second, it likely made him popular, since this previous governor had made it a habit of corruptly enriching himself by selling grain at inflated prices, or threatening to do things like kill all of the crocodiles in Egypt until the cults that revered the animals paid a huge bribe to stop it. So by executing him, Ptolemy got to position himself as a champion of Egyptian religion. And third, maybe this is the most important, after killing him, Ptolemy got to take his vast hoard of corrupt wealth, which was very useful in the coming campaigns. See, Ptolemy had absolutely no interest in ruling all of Alexander's empire. He had been with Alexander in Egypt and accompanied him to the Siwa Oasis. And it was there that he likely decided it was more practical and profitable to be pharaoh of Egypt rather than emperor of everything from Italy to India. But he also knew that sooner or later, Perdiccas would be coming for him, and he needed to prepare for a world in which the Diadochi were battling over their pieces of the empire. In fact, that breakdown came almost immediately, starting with an act of body theft. See, increasingly, it looked like Perdiccas, who had argued for keeping the empire intact for Alexander's heirs, was in fact positioning himself to become more ruler than regent. Not long after the partition, he assassinated his main political rival in Babylon. Next, Perdiccas set off from Babylon to Anatolia, modern Turkey, hoping to conquer some cities and states within the empire that Alexander had bypassed on his lightning campaigns. This also conveniently put him close to Macedon, setting up a possible grab for the homeland, and he also had Alexander's half-sister killed when she married her daughter to Philip III in a bid to control the puppet king and make him sole ruler. An unpopular move that triggered a brief mutiny in Perdiccas' army. And of course, just to be clear, we are simplifying a lot of stuff here to try to keep our focus on Ptolemy and Egypt. Just wanted to call that out. We know there's a lot more going on here. Yet despite being supreme commander of the army, regent of the empire, guardian to the incompetent Philip III, and toddler Alexander IV, he had no real claim to the throne. But that changed when he opened marriage negotiations with Cleopatra of Macedon, Alexander's only full sister. This would give him a direct claim, given Philip's incapacity and the fact that Alexander IV was half Persian. Though he also had another key asset. Alexander's body. In Macedonian culture, the person who interred a king gained a great deal of royal prestige, since this was generally done by their successor. And Alexander had already taken on a godlike stature to the army and empire. This was reflected in the care of his body. In fact, while Perdiccas was campaigning in Anatolia, and Ptolemy solidifying his power base in Egypt, artisans from across the empire had been conducting a two-year project to preserve Alexander's body and transport it in the manner befitting a god king. Generally, Macedonians cremated royal dead and interred their ashes. We know this from a tomb generally attributed to his father Philip, but interestingly, Alexander was prepared more in an Egyptian fashion. He was placed in a gold sarcophagus with preservative herbs, suggesting he was at least partially mummified. And this did make sense when you think about it, because Alexander had supposedly requested to be buried in the Siwa Oasis, where he'd been declared son of Zeus Amon. Thus, the agreement had been to transport him there, but that would give Ptolemy the prestige. And if Perdiccas instead entombed him in Macedon? Well, that would have some huge significance, wouldn't it? So when the word came that the funeral cart was ready to depart, Perdiccas made plans to head for Macedon, He sent word to his lieutenant to depart from Babylon with the funeral procession, but not towards Egypt as planned. He wanted the body to meet him in Anatolia. Perdiccas reasoned that by the time Ptolemy realized Alexander's body had been rerouted, Perdiccas would already be on his way to Macedon to bury the king, marry his sister, imprison Alexander's other heirs, and make himself ruler of the empire. Clever plan! Or at least it seemed clever, until Perdiccas got word that en route, the funeral cart had turned south and was headed towards Egypt after all. What? Yeah, turns out Ptolemy had made the lieutenant a double agent. While conspiring with Perdiccas to bring Alexander to Anatolia, the officer had privately made a deal with Ptolemy to bring the cart to Egypt as originally intended. Okay, but you know what? There was still time to catch it, because the cart was essentially a tomb on wheels, and traveled at a glacial pace given the hard roads, heavy load, and crowds emptying their villages and towns to gawk at the wonder. So, Perdiccas dispatched cavalry to chase it down before it reached Egypt. Now, luckily, they caught up with it at Damascus, well outside Ptolemy's territory, but unluckily, they were too late. Ptolemy was already there, having marched a massive army north out of his Egyptian territory. Of course, the PR line for this was that it was an honor guard to receive the remains of the king and accompany it to Egypt. But in reality, Ptolemy had done a rug pull on Perdiccas, capturing Alexander's corpse and collapsing the regent's plans to march into Macedon and make himself king. Though it was also at this point that it did become clear that this body snatching was about Ptolemy's wishes, not Alexander's, because Ptolemy had no intention of entombing the golden coffin at Siwa, where it might be vulnerable to recapture from the coast. Instead, he entombed it at the more secure location of Memphis. The end result was, of course, war. Within a year of the theft, Perdiccas headed south with his army, ready to smash the rebel Ptolemy and assert his right as both regent and king. He would also do this personally, sending other armies to re-secure Babylon and other elements of the far-flung empire who had clearly colluded with Ptolemy. But again, Ptolemy was ready for him. In fact, he'd spent the 3 years since the partition raising an army, hiring mercenaries, and acquiring ships to turn his new territory into Fortress Egypt. He also made good use of the terrain, fortifying the Nile River, which may have been in flood, since the currents were so strong that Perdiccas' first attempt to cross collapsed when he built a dam across the river, which, collapsed. His second attempt involved the siege of a fortress, making the most of Alexander's elite veterans and the elephants remaining from the campaign in India. Though the elephant corps could not be easily countered and they demolished the fortress, Ptolemy's responding army once again drove Perdiccas across the river. Next time he faced elephants, Ptolemy would be more prepared. Despite arriving with overwhelming force, Perdiccas had lost twice, and some of his commanders were starting to get itchy. They were also probably getting messages from Ptolemy offering huge payoffs to switch sides, which is why in summer of 320 BC, three commanders entered Perdiccas's tent. Backing up a bit, it had been a bad day. Perdiccas had made another attempt to cross the Nile at a ford, this time with the idea of using elephants standing upstream as a sort of living dam. This did work brilliantly at first, with 2,000 men making it across and beginning to marshal on the opposite bank. But as the elephants shifted their feet, stirring up the bottom and sinking deeper into the silt, the strength of the current increased until the river was no longer fordable, stranding the 2,000 in front of Ptolemy's marshaling army. Of course, they tried to swim back across, but the vast majority drowned, with 1,000 of them swept downstream in the raging waters to where a large group of crocodiles feasted on their struggling bodies as the army watched helpless. This was the last straw. The three officers, probably at the urging of Ptolemy, drew their swords and butchered Perdiccas in his tent. Soon, there would be a new conference, a new regent, and the entirety of the Diadochi would be at war. Meanwhile, Ptolemy, master of Egypt, would sit back and let others fight it out. He had picked the richest satrapy, the one most likely to hold, and he rarely ventured out except when threatened, and only then with overwhelming force. His role in the wars of the Diadochi would be that of a diplomat and funder of military expeditions. He would sponsor armies rather than lead them. And his rule would never be seriously threatened while he completed his grand ambition, establishing the Ptolemaic dynasty. Which, admittedly, is a little harder than my grand ambition of establishing the Ptolemaic dynasty playlist. Okay, hear me out. It's going to have all the bangers I think Ptolemy would have really related to, okay? Of course, we've got Walk Like an Egyptian, right? Then we'll have Empire State of Mind. Ooh, and then Your Idol by the Saja Boys. Oh, yeah. And I can listen to it all in crystal clear clarity anywhere thanks to my new swanky bone conduction headphones from Raycon. While both Jeff and I converted to using Raycon's everyday earbuds a few years ago, we just got these new bone conduction headphones, and they are seriously like next level stuff. They send sound through vibrations in your bones, leaving your ears open to the world around you, which works awesome for someone like me who wants to stay aware while jamming out in the chaos of NYC. I actually just wore them to go vote the other day. It was pretty sweet. Not to mention they have a 13-hour battery life, are water and sweat resistant, and are designed with a no-bud fit that never slips. Check this out. Yeah, they're still there. Ha! Take that, active lifestyle. Not to mention, they start at half the price of other premium headphones while still sounding great. So, whether you're listening to history and RPG podcasts like me, Ptolematic playlists perhaps, which is a real thing, or just want to vibe out with your favorite YouTube channels while multitasking, Raycon's got you covered. Actually, quite literally, because they offer a free 30-day happiness guarantee, no questions asked. Plus, for Black Friday and Cyber Monday, you can save up to 30% off all Raycon audio products site-wide by using our link buyraycon.com/extrahistorybc. Just click the link in the description to upgrade your sound, or better yet, get ahead on holiday gift giving. But we are told that the deal won't last long, so please make it snappy to make you and your loved ones' ears happy. Again, to hear the Raycon difference for yourself, click here. And then once you've upgraded your audio equipment, why not use it to listen to our next episode here? Thank you so much to Zeliad's Architectures, Lotus Wolf, Kuyakoi, Joseph Blame, Hunter Z, Dominic Valenciana, Arles Arles Posting, and Angelo Valenciana for being the best legendary patrons.